This afternoon's docket, Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton, and we'll hear from Mr. Ramsey.
May it please the court, John Ramsey on behalf of the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton and in defense of House Bill 1181, a law that was passed by the Texas House and the Texas Senate one vote shy of a combined unanimous vote. The purpose of HB 1181 is to address the recognized harm caused when Texas children have unfettered access to unlimited pornography on websites like plaintiffs' websites in the year 2023. The district court enjoined the enforcement of HB 1181, so that means the standard of review here is abuse of discretion, where conclusions of law are reviewed de novo and findings of fact are reviewed for clear error. So with all due respect to the district court judge, that's where I start, with clear error. Because clear error on crucial factual findings caused the district court to 1, overlook Ginsburg, 2, misapply Ashcroft, and 3, misjudge the balance of equities. So first, I will clarify the factual record, and then I will review those three issues as it pertains to the age verification requirement of HB 1181, and then after that I will discuss the Communications Decency Act and then the notice requirement. There are two errors in particular that pervade the opinion. First, the Honorable District Court Judge turned away from some of the most important evidence in this case, and that is the content on plaintiffs' websites and website like plaintiffs' websites. The District Court believed that the film Last Tango in Paris, a 1972 film starring Marlon Brando, was, quote, as raw as any pornography. Unfortunately, he is sadly mistaken. When I suggested that the court review the evidence to the contrary, the exact response was, quote, it ain't happening.
What does that get you? Assuming that the court didn't review crush videos and rape videos and bestiality, and I could think, what difference does that make here?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it pervades the entire opinion because in the end, it keeps the district court from making an appropriate assessment of whether the content might be obscene, whether the warnings make sense, whether the statute is under-inclusive, and whether the balance of harms favor the state.
Now, in terms of the procedural posture, so we're here on an appealable order granting an injunction. As I understand it, though, irrespective of what we do here, the case will be in the district court and presumably for full factual development at some point. Is that right? So that any of the additional facts that you want to present or even controverting other facts that have already been found, you'll have that opportunity. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. The lower court, so this court will proceed in the lower district court, but those factual findings.
As I understand, I just was looking at the district court docket sheet, so it's only at the complaint stage. The complaint hadn't even been answered yet. Is that right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's exactly right. So
I didn't mean to interrupt your train of thought. I was just trying to understand where we are in terms of your statement that
that
facts were incorrectly decided. Okay.
So, and I don't want to describe here the content on plaintiffs' websites, but a written glimpse of it, is provided at ROA 366 through 368 and 399.
It's the kind of things I was just mentioning, right?
I'm sorry.
Crush videos, rape videos, bestiality, sex with the corpse, violent. Is it something I've missed? Probably.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No.
I'm sure you have missed some things, but to the extent that that is an accurate assessment of some of the things on plaintiff's website, you are correct.
Okay. Is there something else that you need to bring to our attention that's on the website or?
No, Your Honor, the reason I'm bringing this content up is because the district court specifically misunderstood the severity of the content.
Okay.
Well, Judge Edwards been around a long time. He's a San Antonio lad that came back home, and he's one of our really fond district judges. I don't really think he's naive, but go ahead.
Assuming that it is much worse than what he said it was, from your perspective, it's much more intense or whatever the right word would be. Where does that get you, or what's your point on this?
Yes, so one example was he asked if potentially because YouTube has some sexual material on it, it will have to verify its users' ages with the state. And that resulted in a finding of over-inclusiveness or under-inclusiveness that just isn't borne out by the reality of what is currently on plaintiffs' websites.
So what's the background of the one-third requirement?
The background is that in general there are plenty of laws that govern this type of material. A classic example is sexually oriented businesses, and so in those laws there is often the phrase a substantial portion, and in this particular law the legislature just went ahead and put a quantifiable number to it, one third. The second error that the district court committed that pervades the opinion is the district court clearly misunderstood how age verification works. In particular, the district court asserted that age verification will allow the government to log and track down what pornographic videos a person watches. And you can find that at ROA 1729 and 30. And the ruling even suggests that pornographic websites will be required to transmit user data to the state. And that's at ROA 1706.
I thought they weren't supposed to keep the data.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Under the statute itself.
It would be a prohibition of the statute for the third-party age verifier to keep that information. And the way that age verification is actually works is in the record at ROA 1835 through 41. Which is the sworn testimony of Tony Allen, the only age verification expert to testify in this case, and at ROA 402 through 424, which is the declaration of Mr. Allen, which also includes links to age verification providers like Yodi.
How does the age verification work under the statute?
So the age verification component of the statute allows for a wide variety of age verification methods. So I want to clarify a few things on this very issue. One, the state of Texas has absolutely nothing to do with the age verification process. The only connection, if it could be called a connection.
Except creating it.
Well, that's true. The legislature did pass the law. You're right, Your Honor. So as far as the process and the implementation, there is no involvement of the state, except potentially, it's not a connection, but you can use a government ID to verify your age online. You don't have to use a government ID, and you certainly don't have to use a Texas ID. There are all kinds of ways to verify your age, and those are listed at 408 through 412. Another thing I have to clarify is that there are many kinds of businesses that use age verification besides pornographic websites. If you, for instance, want to gift your neighbor a bottle of wine, you will have to use an age verification service. And this is important because in the unlikely event that someone ever found out that you age verified, it would not reveal anything. Certainly not whether you watched pornography, and much less what pornography you watched. And of course, as Your Honor mentioned, age verification services are not allowed to retain data. It would be a violation of the statute.
Do you have to, does the record say anything about whether you need age verification services for online gambling?
Yes, Your Honor. Gambling, tobacco purchasing, some dating websites, that's all in the record and in the declaration of Tony Allen, the age verification expert.
Well, age verification can take a whole wide range of things. The grocery store I shop at requires me to give an ID, unbelievably, because they just have a blanket rule that no matter what, if you purchase an alcohol, you've got to verify that you're 21 years old. And I think verification should do that. So that's the simplest direct form. But you move from that to the tech gauge, and the whole ball game changes because of the multiple ways in which the data is being collected means there's multiple ways in which it's going to be disseminated and retained. And so it's the implementation of it how is it really going to work? That's what I'm trying to understand.
So, and I think that's an important point, Your Honor, because it's a myth that we travel through the internet anonymously. Everywhere we go, information is collected about us. Websites collect data, especially pornographic websites. So they already know their visitor's approximate or exact age. They know their approximate or exact location. They know the device they're using to get to the site.
It's a big business. That's why you get ads, whether it's pornographic material or makeup.
That's right.
They send you targeted ads based upon where you're browsing. Everybody does that.
That's right. And so, and we know that Pornhub does it because they release an annual year in review where they categorize their visitors by these and many other categories. And so that's data collection that they advertise about their users.
So what is the point of this? What does this have to do with the answer? I mean, how does this advance your case?
Well, because, again, the district court judge surmised that we are going from complete anonymity on the internet to now that you've got age verification, the government knows which videos you watch. And that's not true. The truth about age verification is that it does one thing and one thing only. As you travel around the internet, it allows websites like PornSite to get one additional tiny, tiny bit of information, a zero or one, an answer to the question, is this person a child?
So what do you say to the standard of review that applies here? The opposing brief starts off with, it says, the Supreme Court has twice held that strict scrutiny applies, and only the least restrictive means can be applied. Tell us why you believe this is merely rational basis.
Yes, and so I think the functionality of age verification feeds right into this because it is simple, it is secure, you can do it in 3 to 5 minutes, and you don't need to do it again. And so when you have it properly set, how easy it is and how simplistic it is, then it not only helps determine whether age verification would be the least restrictive means under the analysis in Ashcroft, it determines whether that framework is the right framework at all, or whether instead we rely on Ginsburg. And to answer your question, Judge Elrod, we should look to Ginsburg, because the distinguishing factor between Ginsburg, decided in 1968, and Ashcroft, decided at the turn of the century, is not that Ginsburg involves a magazine and Ashcroft involves the internet. It's that the shopkeeper in Ginsburg could determine whether his customers were a child, and the potential defendant in Ashcroft could not. So the underlying statute in both cases is nearly identical, and they're nearly identical to the statute that we have here in HB 1181. But in Ginsburg, the court starts with the question, can adults still access the content? And the answer was yes. That's an explicit understanding of Ginsburg. And because the answer was yes, the question became, well, can we prohibit children from having this content that is harmful to them? And the answer was clearly yes, and they applied the rational basis on their ability, on the government's ability to protect children. So that decision, Ginsburg, was reaffirmed by all nine Supreme Court justices in 2011 in the case Brown versus Media Entertainment Media Merchants. But in 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court asked a similar question in U.S. versus American Libraries Association. The Supreme Court analyzed whether it was constitutional to require a public library to restrict access to pornography as the default. And the court asked the same question it asked in Ginsburg. Can adults still access the pornography? And the answer was again yes, with only a little bit of effort and delay. And once it reached the answer to that question.
Does the state take the position that the adults should be able to access all of this material, or does the state take the position that some of this is obscene? And that therefore it would violate community standards of Texans or something like that, and not, what is the state's position on that?
Well, HB 1181's position is that adults should still be able to access
all of this material, crushed videos, rapes, everything.
HB 1181 does not change the content available to adults in any way. So the court in ALA reached the same conclusion. Because adults can still access the content, the rational basis review applies. So we can ask the same question here. Once we understand how age verification works, we can ask the same question here. Does this statute allow adults to access the material harmful to minors? And the answer is once again, yes. So 50 years ago, a person selling material to a minor could know his customer was a child. 25 years later, at the dawn of the public internet, that was no longer true. but it's now 25 years more, again later, and we've come back to Ginsburg.
So to the extent that Ashcroft would seem to make some points about filters and that sort of thing, should we be using that case from that time period to make those points, or should we look at the record here on what the technology is?
Even Ashcroft acknowledged that the technology would change, and it specifically found that age verification may one day be the better option, that content filtering wouldn't always be the least restrictive means. And of course, there are some key differences, one major legal differences and several factual differences between this case and Ashcroft. As we hammer in the briefing, one of the differences is that pornography is now ubiquitous and far more graphic. Second is that pornography is accessible at the fingertips and in the pockets of 11-year-olds on a school bus, and not just at a computer in the living room. But third, to your point, Judge Elrod, content filtering is widely available, and it's used, and its existence is widely known, and you can see that from plaintiff's own expert at ROA 166 through 69. And this matters because Ashcroft makes clear that when analyzing whether a law is the least restrictive means to achieve a government interest, the status quo is not considered among the options. And content filtering is now the status quo. The dissent in Ashcroft actually had this exact concern all the way back in 2004. And the dissent was concerned that content filtering was the status quo and that age verification was unjustly compared to it. Now it's 20 years later, and one thing all the parties agree on is that, and the experts of the parties agree on, is that content filtering is widely available, widely publicized by big tech companies, and widely implemented, and the options are cheap and plentiful. You can see that at ROA 166 through 69, 1849, and 1739. The court describes it as commonplace on devices. So because of Ashcroft, content filtering is the only tool we've used for the last 20 years. And yet, in 2002, as the record shows, 75% of teenagers had viewed pornography, with the average age of first exposure at 13. And that study's referenced at ROA 343. So the status quo is not working. And this leaves age verification alone as the non-status quo means of addressing the well-recognized harm.
If we were to gather that data so precise as to who's watching it, when they don't have the ability to identify them.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand your question.
Well, you rattled off the percentage of people who are using it, gaining access to it. I don't know how that data can be gathered other than by a computer.
There are studies in which children are surveyed. And to that point, Your Honor, I will point out that at this point, there have been enough studies to show the harm of pornography to children that universities and research scientists are having a hard time doing those studies, because in order to fund those studies and justify those studies, they have to prove, or they have to show that they're doing more good than harm. And so these studies are very difficult to do now because the harm is so well recognized that researchers can't expose children to pornography, obviously.
You need to use some of your time to discuss the compelled speech argument on the disclosures and also Section 230.
Yes, Your Honor. I will make sure to do that, Your Honor.
I have a question about the compelled speech, if that would be an okay segue of that. I wanted to know is if there are parts of the warnings that would be overbroad, but parts that would be okay, does the court take out its pencil, or is it not allowed to take out its pencil at this stage? Yes. Sometimes we do that to tailor something that's overbroad. I'm not saying it is, but are we allowed to do that, and are you asking us to do that?
Yes, the Texas Government Code Section 311 does contain a provision that would allow you to do that, and certainly you'd be well within precedent of other circuits to do that. In particular, the court in Rounds versus Minnesota Planned Parenthood took a pencil word to word to the warnings in that case. So, to Your Honor's suggestion, with regard to the Communications Decency Act, I'll be brief. This issue is well pleaded, and the analysis largely turns on this court's own precedents in Doe v. MySpace and Net Choice v. Paxton. I would like to point out three quick things. First, the opening paragraph of the MySpace opinion explains how that website operates and interacts with its users and uploaders in far more detail than is available to us about plaintiffs. And that's to be expected because that was a lawsuit brought by a plaintiff who was presumably able to research their claim and present their findings to the court. And here we have a very shortened timeline with multiple plaintiffs, with multiple websites alleging CDA immunity. So whether they have a valid CDA defense or not, an expedited PI with the opportunity without the opportunity for discovery is not the place to determine that under what is now a very fact-specific inquiry. Second, in MySpace, the plaintiff had waived any argument that MySpace was actually a content creator and not simply a host of content, and we did not. And the court.
So your pleadings say that they are creator as well as a host.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they haven't answered yet or moved to dismiss on that, right?
So when you say our pleadings, our response to the PI mentioned that they were content hosts, and we in fact provided an affidavit of someone who had visited their sites.
Because you haven't answered yet. Yeah.
That's right. We haven't actually done the motion to dismiss yet. Yes, Your Honor. So I'm referring to our response to the PI.
Did the district court make a finding on that?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court found that one of the plaintiff's websites that had claimed CDA immunity did not actually have it, and then the others did.
And the district court also didn't determine that the foreign entities would have this? Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court rejected our argument regarding foreign organizations not having constitutional rights, and I hope to revisit that as well.
Let's go back to compelled speech for just a minute. I don't understand why this isn't compelled speech, because you're requiring a statement that says, in essence, our product, our content, is dangerous and bad. Implication being, you should stay away from it. Why isn't that compelled speech?
I think it is. I think it falls under the analysis of compelled speech. So the question is, what framework do we use? Because there are places and times where the government is allowed to compel speech. And so,
well, where it was compelled to state facts, but here this is more of an opinion or a point of view.
The record supports the warnings. And you know, the ultimate question we're asking is which case among compelled speech cases is most over the target here? And for the foreign plaintiffs, the foreign organizations, that case is AOSI-2. And the foreign organizations do not have constitutional rights. And in fact, in AOSI, the court specifically held that the government could compel the speech of foreign organizations. And to be clear, the organizations in that case believed that adopting a policy that explicitly opposed prostitution would undermine their work combating AIDS and HIV. But the U.S. Supreme Court held that as foreign organizations operating abroad, they do not have constitutional rights. So as to 7 of the 10 plaintiff websites, the leading case is AOSI-2, and the finding it should be that they do not have constitutional rights. And the district court found that they had constitutional rights because they have websites. But to find that the foreign plaintiffs have constitutional rights would require this court to find that people posting things on the internet that people in America can read grants a person constitutional rights and the rights to sue under Section 1983, which of course would completely do away with the court's finding in AOSI 2. So at the very least, the state recommends this court should do what the court did in AOSI 2 and limit any constitutional considerations to the domestic operations. Now, with regard to the domestic websites and their claim for compelled speech, we look to Brown, which says that the government is allowed to impose content-based restrictions on speech when, quote, there is a persuasive evidence of a long tradition to that effect. And in fact, Brown cited Ginsburg for such an example of that tradition, and then NIFLA, the leading case cited by plaintiffs, and a good case that does provide a good rundown of the law regarding this area. NIFLA cited to Brown and its decision. So what NIFLA does is it determines that there are certain areas, like commercial speech, where the government can't compel speech. And among those areas, it specifically, like I said, references Brown, and Brown, in that regard, is referencing Ginsburg and the right of the government to restrict and restrict speech that is obscenity to minors. Thank you, Your Honors.
You've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Ramsey. Thank you.
5 minutes. Thank you.
All right. You'll have to tell me if it's Schaefer or Schaffer.
Schaefer, Your Honor.
Schaefer.
Many people make that mistake. Got it right.
Thank you, Judge Smith, and may it please the court. Your Honors, we submit that this is a straightforward case for affirmance, considering, as Your Honors noted, that the court reviews the district court's issuance of a preliminary injunction, that's all it is, solely to determine whether the court abused its discretion.
So the one of the main questions, if not the main question, is what, in your view, is left of Ginsburg insofar as it affects this case?
Your Honor, we could not bring a claim on behalf of minors to access materials that are obscene as to them. We are not invoking the First Amendment rights of minors to access this material. And if we were dealing within the physical space, different from the electronic or internet space, Ginsburg would be an apt precedent. But the Supreme Court has repeatedly, subsequent to Ginsburg, made clear that outside of the physical store context, when we're talking about the internet, particularly in Reno, in Ashcroft, but also in Sable Communications, in Playboy, if the restriction to protect minors is encroaching upon adults' access to content of their choosing that is not obscene content, strict scrutiny applies. And as you were alluding to, Judge Smith, the record will continue to be developed below. It can be developed very expeditiously. We're eager to proceed at speed. But the Supreme Court was especially clear in the Ashcroft case that the correct result in our present posture and in cases like this is to allow a preliminary injunction to stand. I'd commend to the court 542 U.S. at 670-71. It goes through the specific reasons why a preliminary injunction should remain in effect as a record is made, including as to the relevant technology, including as to any evolutions in technology.
What do you mean by that, including as to any? Shouldn't we look at this record? What the technology is now.
Judge Elrod, absolutely. And you have rigorous fact-finding from Judge Ezra on every point the court has covered. And although Mr. Ramsey today says that there's some clear error in certain factual findings, I don't think you'll find any argument in the briefing.
But we don't say, well, because Ashcroft said you should use this other method, then therefore that's the method that has to be used for all time.
Here's what it said, Judge Elrod. We defer to the district court's fact-finding. The fact-finding at this stage establishes that content filtering is available as a less restrictive alternative, that any errors, if there are errors, should be resolved in favor of the First Amendment. And because you're dealing with a new statute that has never been enforced, the equities, irreparable harm, the larger calculus weighs in favor of affirming a preliminary injunction. Those are the
aspects. Say that if you have a new statute, I thought that our VC case, where does it say because it's new, you get an extra bump?
Justice Kennedy says because this statute has never been enforced, there's never been a prosecution, no prosecution will be interfered with. The status quo is that there's been no enforcement action, and all that's happening during the pendency of the preliminary injunction as the case proceeds to final judgment is the status quo is being maintained. So that's the reasoning that I consider apt here, as well as the fact that the case, as with all of the Supreme Court cases on this subject and all of the lower court precedents to date, says strict scrutiny is the applicable standard for analyzing likelihood of success on the merits.
Don't we still have to evaluate likelihood of success on the merits?
Yes, Judge Smith, you do. But I'm just saying that to the extent that we are likely to succeed for the reasons that are set forth in Reno, in Ashcroft, and in Judge Ezra's 81-page opinion, it's not a difficult case to affirm that preliminary injunction. It really does track how both Reno and Ashcroft were decided with unstayed preliminary injunctions remaining in effect, even as there were disputes about different aspects of the technology. And as Your Honor points out, that will be resolved through full development of a full record before the district court, but in the meantime, the First Amendment interests that hang in the balance, the equities, the prospects of irreparable harm, all weigh in favor of saying the new statute should not be enforced. That's my submission to your honors about what is apt.
Not to replow old ground for at least for very long, but if I understood what you said, Ginsburg is inapplicable to this case because Ginsburg it applies only to physical stores, so that in your view, we ignore Ginsburg entirely.
I think you credit Ginsburg as far as it goes, but only so far. And I, again, if you were to perceive us to be arguing, Judge Smith, that minors have a right to access the materials in question, I think you could say that that argument is wrong. We're here arguing on behalf of adults and on behalf of the sites themselves that are trying to provide adult content to an adult audience and are having that burdened.
But okay, can you explain to me or to us why it is that you can make people have an ID at the adult place and why you couldn't make people have an ID on the internet?
Sure, and I would commend to the court the specific findings from Judge Ezra about just how burdensome age verification is in practice. He went through it at the record at 1727 and 32. It's really because age verification, and the state describes it well in their brief, Judge Elrod, what you have to do in order to comply, as we understand the law and as Texas articulates the law, in front of a computer, the user will have to either take a selfie, an actual photograph, to withstand age verification, or have facial analysis performed by the computer, or use something like a government-issued ID that is a surefire proxy for
Isn't
being an adult.
Is really easy now? We've all done that with COVID tests and all kinds of things. We do that all the time nowadays.
Well, Judge Elrod, I think not when accessing very intimate materials that may reveal sexual preferences, especially in a state that continues to stand by anti-sodomy laws and may say that same-sex inclinations are prosecutable in some certain context. And that's something that Judge Ezra specifically noted.
What state is that?
Texas, Your Honor, as I understand the law. But and Judge Ezra noted as much as 1730 of the record. But in addition to that, there's a great amount of experience.
I'm sorry, but that I'm just very confused by that. Isn't Lawrence v. Texas a case that was decided? So how could that be?
I would defer to Mr. Ramsey on this. I believe Texas still reserves rights, notwithstanding that Supreme Court precedent, to enforce the law that remains on its books today. And that was noted in the opinion below at 1730.
So you think it's more burdensome because as technology gets better and it's easier to do verification, you still think it's burdensome because you think that there is an anonymity right on the internet that is not present at the store?
Well, let me unpack this a bit. One thing that Judge Ezra found, and I think is amply supported by the record, is that there is more risk of information getting out on the internet today. There have been hacks, including of government databases when information is retained. The statute does not prevent age verification information from being sent in transmission to any number of third parties. There's no recourse under the statute if age verification is retained. The government, of course, retaining authority to prosecute under or to enforce the statute, can inquire as to age verification.
Aren't existing internet privacy laws very protective of all those things? That if any time it gets out, there is a whole step process and you have to provide notice, and we already have internet privacy laws that protect for that.
Well, I would just say that Texas here, in trying to pursue its purposes and claiming that it maximally respects privacy, has not put anything into the statute that provides assurance to users who will be chilled for the reasons that the district court found by the prospect of this information getting out. One other thing about the evolution of technology, it is easier than ever to circumvent age verification. That's specifically found by the district court and explained because there are ways to mask where you actually are geographically, so it could look like you're not accessing a website from Texas, and minors are more adept at that than adults are. So
that's the same thing for filtering.
Actually,
you can go around the filters and get them. You can turn them off. Minors can do that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Nothing is foolproof. I think that is true. But this statute is specifically porous in the ways that are specifically identified in the findings. One is that social media sites, everything that Your Honor was recounting before, crush videos, terrible videos, if those search terms are entered and the graphic images or videos are returned through a search engine, This statute doesn't do anything to stop that from happening.
But that under-inclusivity is not always considered a barrier to the constitutionality. You don't have to take something on full-throated at all at the same time.
I think it's a problem under strict scrutiny that the Supreme Court has specifically recognized, including in cases like Brown, which my friends for Texas rely upon. But it's also social media sites where this can be accessed. But my point, Judge Elrod, is content filtering answers this. Because content filtering, when it's on a device or a set of devices, will screen out all of these different sources. And the Supreme Court said repeatedly, in Reno and in Ashcroft, the first thing the government should do is explore at least content filtering. Texas has not done that in the least.
Isn't content filtering much more overbroad? Because you have put something in and it'll take away your learning about cancer or something, and you were trying to not see a breast or something. The content filtering is very known to be overbroad.
It can be. There's no such. I don't think there's any indication of that in the findings. I don't think the record would support that. But in addition, content filtering puts the responsibility where it should be, in the home and on parents. And you can have more or less restrictive filters, but you can adjust that as parents see fit. The legislative record, and this is found at 1740 and 41, totally blank on these points. There is no explanation from Texas's legislature as to why content filtering was considered and found wanting. They simply went as far as they did with adult verification and all of the under-inclusiveness. There's no explanation as to why that is so. And under strict scrutiny, that in and of itself, Judge Smith, is an indication of our likely success.
If we were to apply rational basis, do you lose?
Under rational basis, I would have a tough time, but I would say, Judge Elrod, that if there was no other reason for heightened scrutiny, it's the fact that this is speaker-based discrimination, the fact that it is only the companies that my friends for Texas call big porn that are subject to this law. And you
Is it speaker-based discrimination? Because doesn't that run counter to your "we're only the platform" Section 230 argument? The opposing briefs make a point about you can't have your cake and eat it too in that way.
I don't think that we're having our cake and eating it too. I think the explanation for that is it's specific companies that were the targets of this law. They're identified oftentimes by name. They're not very numerous. And other companies that provide the identical content, and per the district court's finding, I believe it's at 1730 or 1735, they are more of the gateway to porn for minorities. They're left completely unregulated here. That is a telltale sign of speaker-based discrimination, which is its own First Amendment problem. We are, after all, dealing with content, and content that, as Mr. Ramsey said, for purposes of this statute, it is not obscene. The state wants to enforce its obscenity laws. That's a separate case. This law is regulating speech that is not obscene and is therefore protected, and the fact that it's singling out only one set of providers of indistinguishable content is a sign of speaker-based discrimination, is a reason why strict scrutiny would apply even if there were no other. I'd also note, Judge Elrod, I don't see an answer from Texas in its briefing about this, not either denying that there is speaker-based discrimination at work or that that presents its own species of First Amendment problem. And then there's the health warnings, and I do want to make sure that we talk about those, Judge Smith, because it ties together with age verification. After a user goes through this process of identifying himself or herself, the specific image of that individual, what do they find waiting for them? And that's all at the command of the state of Texas. They come in and they get warnings that say, you should not be here, essentially. This is bad content. It is dangerous content. And you are, by virtue of consuming the content, complicit in crimes. That's in the health warnings.
Well, it doesn't exactly say that, does it?
I think that's the message, Judge Elrod. I take a little bit of liberty, to be sure, but I do think that the district court was absolutely right to say that that is all the more chilling.
Do you agree with the opposing counsel, your friend, that we could take our pencil out and say this part's okay, that part's not okay?
I don't. And of course, a few reasons why. The first is there is no such argument that was made to Judge Ezra, even in the alternative. It was never suggested to him that he could have a preliminary injunction that was partial, let alone so granular that it was changing words of the statute and leaving some in effect and others not. Second reason why.
So you think they've abandoned that position?
I don't think it's preserved. That's true. And as Your Honor knows, I think federal courts are very reluctant to redline state statutes. And to do that at that level of actually changing health warnings that are meant to be attributed to the Texas Health Department, for the court, you'd essentially be changing what is the supposed position of the Texas Health Department without having any indication from the legislature that they wanted that. I'd also note there's no severability clause in the statute to the extent that that is any kind of an indication for Your Honor. And last, Your Honor, there were problems found with the health warnings that transcend the specific text. They were found to be unduly burdensome because they have to be in 14-point font in a context that where people speak in terms of pixels. It really is inapt that way. Certain of the warnings, the hotlines, have to be on every single web page, every single web page. And the requirements attach even to individual advertisements where the warnings, just the size of them and the number of the warnings, may swamp the advertisements themselves.
Can we talk about the call-in number thing?
Yes.
Is this different than a gambling one because that industry's gotten together in order to try to avoid some other scrutiny and agreed to do those? Or how is this different than other call this hotline if you have this problem that people have to do in all sorts of contexts?
A couple of different reasons. One is there's no science to support the notion, and Texas doesn't even claim to have science to support the notion that mental health or substance abuse are mental health problems or substance abuse result from pornography. The only thing that Texas—
They don't have anything in the record, a declaration from scientists that say that pornography leads to mental health and substance abuse problems?
I don't believe that they have that in terms of a causal relationship and those specific problems, but in their brief, they don't argue that. As I read their brief, they just say, well, it's truthful information because the hotlines exist, pretending as though they're not drawing the link that I think any reader would take from the warning,
well,
which
that's
is
why
because you're on this site, that's why you need to be mindful of these particular problems.
Pornography is potentially biologically addictive. I was going to ask you if you believe that's false and if there's something in the record that establishes that that's false or true, either one. You know, this has been very expedited and, you know, trying to get through this record.
Within the language of the Supreme Court's decisions in Zouderer and in NIFLA, we believe, number one, it is controversial. There's a raging policy debate about whether this is harmful and
potentially biologically. It doesn't say it is, but there are many scientists who would say that it causes a brain change.
But Judge Elrod, there are—
Is that in this record or is that not in this record?
If you look at 1748 and 1758, that's where it's addressed in the record, and specifically, Judge Ezra went through and explained why claims that are made in the warnings are not backed even by the state's studies. In particular, they claim a causal relationship when there is not a causal relationship. It's on, I think the parts about the science are in 1756.
But is there evidence in the record that this is his finding?
Yes.
Scientific, I think there's a reference to an Oxford study in the brief. Are these studies in the record such that what you could establish that especially children who don't have a full frontal cortex and are using their amygdala, that they are more susceptible, especially when they don't have hardened neural, that their brains are not formed yet?
I don't believe so, Judge Elrod. Our own expert, Professor Lay, explained why those claims are not scientifically backed up. Judge Ezra looked at the studies and found at least controversy and said specifically the claim of causation. You can look at note 21, that specifically for what Texas is claiming in its briefing and in the warning, that it is that sensation seeking is predictive of pornography consumption, not the other way around. So there may be a correlation in these respects, but it is not a causal relationship that science has established. Also, he found, and Texas doesn't deny, that the hotlines that are being referenced are not able, the people there are not trained to cope with pornography addiction, if there is such a thing. So essentially the warnings are referring people to supposed help that would not be helpful to them. In addition, there's a claim that the agency is responsible for these warnings, but the agency has not, in fact, by any indication in the record, arrived at these conclusions. And so the Texas legislature is offering a suggestion to these warnings that would actually deceive listeners, contrary to the whole purpose of warnings such as this.
So what if hypothetically, and I'm not going to the size of the font or how often the warnings have to be displayed, What if the only warning that was required was a warning that says, this site contains pornography, period?
Obviously, Judge Smith, that would be less objectionable to us. I do think that if there's going to be the ability for the government to put that sort of a warning on websites, they can do it. There's a longer list that may be controversial. They may want to warn people away in some jurisdictions from firearm sales, or from transgender counseling, or for certain religious views. This warning that. But I think the state to be doing this in a way that is stepping into controversial subject matter, it really is not within the limits of what the Supreme Court has said is acceptable for compelled speech. And certainly you'd want to be careful that the state's not going as far as it is here to make certain speakers involuntarily espouse contested views that are antithetical to them. That's what these warnings do, and that's what is so wrong. And one other point, Judge Elrod. If Texas were to rigorously investigate these problems and conclude, look, there are problems that result from internet consumption, I think they would find that social media is problematic for kids' development. I think they would find that search engines can be bad too, that there's a whole range of content that kids, all of us are concerned about, are taking in on a day-to-day basis that
I
may
think
be bad.
Some people have said that they should ban social media for people under 16 or something. Someone said that. You know, people say that. I'm not saying anything of the sort. I'm responding positively to your comment.
And we're not policymakers, of course, mm-hmm. Robert. What I would tell you is if policymakers were to seriously investigate this and make a record that says we have justifications in science and we've carefully considered the science and here's why every word of this health warning is well-founded, not only do I not believe you would have these warnings, which I think are indefensible, in terms of the science.
Counsel, let me take you back to this causal question again. Implicit throughout the First Amendment jurisprudence has been a deference to parental judgment about the possible injury to the child. So causal relationship in a scientific sense is there, but it also, we have presence, the right of the parent to make their own judgments about that. And the dichotomy we find throughout the First Amendment jurisprudence in treatment of minors has the implicit assumption that there is, it is injurious in some way that it certainly ought to be avoided. At the least, the parents ought to be able to make that call about it. So the scientific connection to this is not determinative. I'm suggesting to you that the categorization of minors versus majority, that's there. The Oklahoma legislature saying that the 18-year-old boys can't buy beer and the females can't. You could quarrel with how accurate those kinds of judgments are, but they're there. And so I'm not sure that causal relationships are prerequisites to joining this thing.
A few points about that, Judge Higginbotham, because I think I agree with every word that you said. One is that was the Supreme Court's emphasis, I think, in Reno and in Ashcroft, that you leave this to the parents, and that's number two. And that's what content filtering does. Content filtering allows individual households to tailor how they're going to police this based upon the parents' view. And number three is, of course, when we talk about minors, we're not talking about a monolithic group. The 17-year-old could be very different from the 3-year-old, very different from the 10-year-old. And this is a statute that lumps them all together, which is part of the concern about how broad it is in its reach, but also why content filtering should be such an obvious alternative for Texas to at least explore. And when you have a legislative record that's blank, when you have a statute that goes after one set of speakers, when the same content is streaming out elsewhere and the legislature is doing nothing about that, and you have the health warnings that pretty well brand these speakers as being bad and toxic and you should stay away, that is an unconstitutional stew, Your Honors. And it was rightly enjoined, I think, by the district court preliminarily, pending further development of a record. Sorry, Judge.
No, it was okay. You were answering my question and you hadn't gotten to the punt, to the meat yet. Do you remember what you were gonna say?
Please, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Forgive me, please. Yes.
It's okay. Normally, you would say that you would leave it to parents, and that's what you would, Judge Higginbotham, have been talking about.
Yes.
But if you have evidence in the record that parents haven't been doing this for 20 or 30 years, and it actually does cause brain damage for kids and causes eating disorders for teenage girls and suicidal ideations. This reminds me of the recent Sixth Circuit case where they've said, you don't leave things, everything is not just left to the parents. If it causes, the state can take a position if it's actually harmfully health-wise to children. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yes. I think you should still expect a legislative record that makes that point, where the legislature has conscientiously considered content filtering and said, here's why it won't work. You don't have that here.
So this was just done in a rushed way and not done with the thoughtfulness that would need to take place for those findings to be made and respected?
Not in a way that would satisfy strict scrutiny. That reflects that the legislature has made a considered judgment that there's no less restrictive alternative available to it. But I also think we would respectfully submit to the legislature through hearings, through presentations, et cetera, that content filtering, and even the state's expert, Mr. Allen, testified to this at the hearing. It works great. It is ubiquitous. It is readily and freely available. It is used by courthouses. It is used by employers.
But parents just are not adept at using it. Well, that's also in the record.
But not everything is unchangeable. And the legislature should try to educate, to promote, to provide this technology to parents who may need it. Note that the health warnings here, the whole premise of them, it seems, is that you can educate users and change behavior. That's presumably the purpose of the health warnings. Why then would the legislature not have tried to get better adoption of content filtering, to say, here's a bill to make sure that schools are talking about this, to make sure we have a PR campaign around it, to make sure that we are specifying the best in class content filtering that is available through Texas? Those things are all available to the legislature. None have been tried. And that's after the Supreme Court in Reno and in Ashcroft specifically called out content filtering as a less restrictive alternative, and when the technology is better now than it has ever been. So in our view, this is an a fortiori case from Reno and Ashcroft. It is especially because of the inclusion of the health warnings, especially because there is speaker-based discrimination here, because content filtering technology is better than ever, because age verification is more restrictive, is more threatening to the user because people are very conscious of how information can come out on the internet, and because you have the health warnings that are their own constitutional problem, this is a law that is rightly preliminarily enjoined. There's no abuse of discretion in that. There's no clear error in the fact finding. And in our view, this case follows naturally from the Supreme Court precedents preceding it, the result in this case to this point. Now, that's not to say that Mr. Ramsey's not going to have the opportunity on remand to make his best record, to show you that there are flaws in our case or problems with Judge Ezra's reasoning and fact-finding. I just think he needs to do that work before he can change the result of the preliminary injunction. We're ready to do that work quickly. We just ask that we have the protection of a preliminary injunction. If we don't have that, a whole new framework comes in. No one quite understands what it means. One of the things that Judge Ezra found is that there's vagueness in this law. There are very threatening dimensions to it, potentially. And so you're going to have a lot of chilling, a lot of compliance costs. You're going to have risks all around as far as figuring out this law and how it applies on the ground. And alternatively, we can just maintain the status quo, get this case finally decided, and it'll come back before your honors. And we'll all be here ready to argue. But
as I listen to you, you're contemplating you are contemplating an ongoing type of discovery or some positive fact development to go forward. And can you share with me what is that plan? What is the discovery plan? What are you going to do?
Well, we need to talk to Mr. Ramsey about that. We've been on pause. We've been all moving very quickly, and we appreciate how quickly the court has been moving. So we haven't had those conversations about the precise schedule. Judge Higginbotham, I don't think it's a very involved discovery process because there is no legislative record in any meaningful sense, and I think our case will be quite straightforward. But there are experts. you know, there are different views about technology and how burdensome is age verification and how readily available is content filtering technology and what explains how you can bridge the gap between what's technologically achievable and what workplaces are doing and what parents may want to be doing more of. So I think those are the sorts of things, expert discovery. The specifics of the health warnings, obviously, I think there are very different views about the soundness of those and how those translate to implementation as specified by the statute. So I think it's that sort of a discovery process. It's a quick discovery process from our perspective, and we'll either decide this case at summary judgment or go through, I think, a relatively fast bench trial.
Could I just ask for clarification? Do you believe it's controversial that pornography is potentially biologically addictive for minors? Do you believe that's controversial?
I believe it is controversial that that's any more addictive than the internet, than games.
It's not more than something else. There are many things that are addictive. Internet, games, gambling, smoking, eating.
I don't want to be unfair to Your Honor's question, Judge Elrod. And having kids, I know that kids who do something on the internet or games, they want to go back to it. As far as whether that is biologically addictive, in the sense that it is triggering a different physiology following that, I think that is very controverted.
I think that's controversial, that the brain is different? Okay, I didn't know that that's what you were saying. I'm just clarifying.
In this sense, Judge Elrod, the person who has a certain brain composition is likelier to seek out pornography. That the pornography is changing that person's brain composition is what I think is the controversial proposition. And that's what I think is not borne out by the science. And certainly, I think the state's studies don't do what they would need to do in order to justify the health warnings.
All right, thank you, Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Ramsey, for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honors. I have to mention that the plaintiffs use age verification for their visitors in other places. They have implemented this technology in other places around the world and here in the United States, in fact, here in Louisiana. And you can find that in the record at ROA 404, 1854, 1856 through 57, and 1891. And of course, this is important for quite a few reasons. First, it shows they can do it. Second, to the extent that they are trying to tell the court that once they implement age verifications, people abandon their platform, we know that Pornhub is a data collection center. It should have the information to present to this court about the amount of visitors it has lost since it implemented age verification other places. Similarly, if they're going to tell the court that it is very costly, they should have the exact numbers to show this court how much it costs when they implemented it in Germany.
Is that fought in Louisiana? Is that in the record?
Your Honor, I believe there was a court hearing today in the Louisiana District Court on this very case, but they are currently age verifying. Pornhub is age verifying in the state of Louisiana.
But it's being contested?
It is. It's ongoing litigation. And then other parts of the world, they have been doing it, and they're required to do
it. Does the EU require this?
Excuse me?
Does the EU require age verification?
I'm not actually sure, Your Honor. I know that Tony Allen testified they're doing this in Germany and other places in the world. So I would also note, just as part of rebuttal, that that my colleague, Mr. Schaefer, and not to be cheesy, but has been great to work with. You say friends, I say friend. He referred to content filtering as ubiquitous and then said the state should go on a PR campaign for something that is already ever-present. Not to mention that content filtering is a product of the biggest tech companies in the world. Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Samsung, Apple. They all have these products that they themselves are trying to get to consumers. As I said before, there's really no doubt that content filtering is status quo. So I want to cover the balance of equities. Because the district court's misunderstanding resulted in error in three separate ways regarding the cost to the plaintiffs. First, as I pointed out, he relieved them of their burden to show what costs they've actually incurred other places where they have implemented this. The cost numbers the district court did use were pulled from the internet 3 years ago from someone who has no personal knowledge of those costs and did not, the costs themselves did not purport to determine whether they are for age verification or identity verification. In contrast, Mr. Allen, who is an auditing member of an association of age verification providers, gave specific specific age verification provider specific information, and also testified that those providers of the service would lower their costs because of the bulk discount involved in this case. You can find that at ROA 157, 420, and ROA 157 and 419 through 422. With regard to the balance of equities, we also talked about the foreign entities not having constitutional rights. So to the extent that this is based on a constitutional injury, if this court should determine they do not have constitutional rights in accordance with AOSI, then they can have no constitutional injury. That leaves you with the domestic websites that are already taking payment information, already requiring people to enter their information and log in every time they come to the site. So the idea that this is going to cause them great harm to just go ahead and make sure the people they're taking money for in exchange for pornography are adults is far-fetched. And then finally, with my final remaining seconds, I want to answer a question that you asked, Judge Elrod, and I would like to point you in the record to ROA 883, and that is where you will find a summary of research regarding the addiction that pornography has on people. And that is an exhibit that was provided by plaintiffs. I would also point you to ROA 1052, so 1052 to 1054. That is also evidence provided by plaintiffs of an academic book provided published by the Oxford University Press that creates a chart and summary of various academic findings regarding the harms of pornography to young people. We do not contest the findings and plaintiffs' evidence there. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thank you, Mr. Ramsey. Your case is under submission, and the court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow.